right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And damn, we got a really exciting show for you today. It's one I've been looking forward to doing for quite some time. At the back end of the show, you're going to hear an interview I did with Bai Di a number of years ago, actually. And Bai Di is the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University. She's also an assistant professor there. And she's the co-author of the book, Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up in the Mao Era. She's going to be talking about the true story of one of the most important and vilified events in human history, the Cultural Revolution, which ties us up into our first guest, which I'm really excited about doing this. Joining us now is Raymond Lada. Raymond's going to be talking with us on the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution in China. Raymond is one of the foremost experts on the Cultural Revolution, and he's the author of You Don't Know What You Think You Know About the Communist Revolution and the Real Path to Emancipation, Its History and Our Future. Raymond's also an advocate for Babovikian's New Synthesis of Communism, a political economist, and the author of American Decline, and a writer for Revcom.us and Revolution Newspaper. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Michael. It's always good to be talking with you and your listening audience.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited about this, and I don't want to waste a second, so I'm going to jump right into it because I got so much. I got a telephone book size of questions for you, okay? So get ready. We're talking about the Cultural Revolution because right now is the 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution, and it's one of the major events in world history, and it's one that's like extremely, you know, people are not clear about it. There's been a lot of assaults on it. There's, you know, the reality of what it was. And then there's all the stuff that's come out to step up against that and to really a lot of confusion about what the Cultural Revolution was. And between 1966 and 1976, China, which was then a socialist country, was rocked by this Cultural Revolution. And beyond that, it had a huge impact on the entire world. And for some, it was inspirational and world-changing, while others saw and continue to see it as a horror. And you state that anyone who wants a just and liberating society and world needs to learn about and learn from the Cultural Revolution. Why?
Well, that's a good setup for this interview. This is the 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution, the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. And this was the high point of the first stage of communist revolution. As we know, Marx was the founder of the science of Marxism, and the first attempt to create a new and liberatory society was the Paris Commune of 1871, and that was very quickly defeated, heroically waged, but quickly defeated. And then the Bolshevik Revolution marked an extraordinary breakthrough. Here, the masses of people led by a visionary communist party, led by Lenin, seized power and went on to build a new socialist society. And that socialist revolution opened up whole new vistas for humanity, but it was defeated. A new capitalist class came to power in the mid-1950s. The Chinese Revolution, led by Mao, came to power in 1949. And this marked the beginning of an extraordinary journey to change society, to change thinking, and to change values. And the Cultural Revolution, which Mao initiated in 1966, was the most radical and far-reaching attempt to revolutionize, to restructure society away from exploitation and oppression on the basis of the conscious activism of tens and hundreds of millions of people. This was the most transformative moment, the most transformative episode in human history, because what this revolution was aiming to do was to carry forward a revolution, as I said, that had come to power in 1949. But Mao, summing up the experience in the Soviet Union, had looked at this problem, a very world historic problem, which is how do you prevent counter-revolution? How do you prevent the rise to power of a new privileged exploiting class? And to do it in a way that's consistent with the goals and aims of this revolution. The communist revolution is about putting an end to all oppression and exploitation, overcoming the very division of human society into classes, and creating a world community of humanity. And the Cultural Revolution was launched as a second revolution, if you will. And it was a revolution that was aimed at identifying and overthrowing new bourgeois forces, within the very leadership, the very leading institutions and structures of Chinese society. And this was what was so unique. Mao had identified a problem that had not been scientifically understood before, which is that socialism is a great leap forward. You have taken state power. You begin to build an economy that's serving the needs of the people. You begin to create new institutions that empower people to take increasing responsibility for the direction of society. But Mao analyzed that two roads open up, that the revolution will go forward towards communism, towards a world without classes and the division, antagonistic divisions between people, or it's going to go back to capitalism. And this was the problem that Mao was confronting. It was not successfully confronted in the Soviet Union under Stalin, and Mao saw that there was a need to develop a new method and approach to dealing with this problem, and that was to rouse the masses of people from below with leadership and to identify and those forces in society and at the top structures, as I said, of the Communist Party and the socialist planning institutions and the educational institutions, but this was concentrated at the top levels of the party, and to call on the masses of people to rise up, to engage in great debate, and to challenge this entrenched authority, and to revolutionize all institutions of society on the basis of actually overthrowing, through mass political mobilization and mass debate and mass criticism, to overthrow these new capitalist forces and to carry the revolution forward. This was incredible, and it affected every institution in society, and it involved the remaking of that socialist society in a more revolutionary way. And this was what the Cultural Revolution was about. And it is vilified, as you said. It is distorted. It is told as a story of disaster, debacle, of chaos, of people being persecuted. But actually, this was the most incredible opening up of society to mass interrogation and to lead people to actually restructure the institutions of society, to change values, the ways in which people relate to each other, that are consistent with where you are trying to go in society and the world. And that is, as I said, to overcome all exploitation and oppression. And the Cultural Revolution was about making that kind of leap, a second revolution to deal with this contradiction that Mao had identified. And that is that the revolution achieves power, but that is not the end of it. It carries out great social change. Land reform took place in China. Industrial reorganization. You know, China was a country in 1949 where there were only 12,000 doctors trained in Western medicine in a society of 500 million people. Well, they developed an incredible medical infrastructure. But by 1965, 1966, you have a phenomenon where most of the medical resources, the health resources, are concentrated in the cities. Why was that? This was because there were those forces within the Chinese Communist Party that were seeking to actually move society in a direction similar to the then capitalist Soviet Union and to build up a society in which new class and social differences were reemerging, and they would actually reimpose capitalism. The situation was very dire in the mid-1960s, and Mao saw, and Babavakian, whose framework of analysis and whose method and approach I base my work on, makes the point, and this was in your interview last week, that Mao had to go outside the party, the vanguard party, in order to kick off this cultural revolution. And he relied on and called forth the young people, the Red Guards, as a catalytic force to open up society to mass interrogation and to the experimentation that was such a hallmark of the Cultural Revolution.
Raymond, let me ask you this, because this is exactly where I was thinking of going to. You know, you've made the case about this was not just something that Mao decided out of sort of some desire to just keep society in turmoil and upheaval, but it was actually really required. It was required. It was really necessary in order to actually maintain socialism and to move ahead in that, as you've made that point. But you also always hear this thing of, and you started to speak to this too, but about, you'll hear from all these people who are detractors of the Cultural Revolution attacking it, that it was about gangs of hooligans terrorizing people, and both perceived enemies or everyday people getting away. How was it actually really carried out? You're throwing in, you know, a huge society, a huge country with a huge society, just so many people all thrown into this. How was this revolution carried out? And it was a real revolution.
Yeah, it was a real revolution in several senses. One, as I said, there was a new capitalist class that had been emerging within socialist society. It called itself socialist. This made it very complicated because these forces were fighting to bring capitalism back, to push China on a capitalist road in the name of socialism. They were saying, we need a big welfare state. We need to invest in the most advanced, most technologically, you know, developed sectors of the economy. We need to rely on measures of efficiency and profitability to jumpstart economic development. They had a whole program. We need an educational system that builds up a new elite. So Mao was identifying that there is the class struggle under socialism between a bourgeoisie and the proletariat. It continues, but it takes this concentrated form as a struggle between these two roads. But the methods of struggle that he called for and that were actually the main form of the Cultural Revolution was mass criticism. And by that, you know, there was no institution in society that was exempt from criticism. And that certainly kicked off in the universities where the Red Guards were challenging autocratic methods of teaching, were challenging the ways in which looking out for oneself and just getting ahead through education was being promoted, again, in the name of this quote-unquote socialist efficiency program, and in ways in which the universities were cut off from the rest of society. There was mass criticism. There was mass debate. One of the exciting things that happened was, you know, you see in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, workers began to form organizations, to issue newspapers, to issue proclamations and manifestos in which they were challenging the ways in which the factories and the city administration were being run. And there was mass debate about, well, is this actually socialist? Is this actually empowering people to take responsibility for the direction of society? So there was mass debate over the existing ways and other ways. And then there was mass political mobilization. The story is often told, and this is what people are fed, this diet that the Cultural Revolution was just a mad, violent upheaval. But in fact, the political mobilization was about overthrowing, through political struggle, these capitalist rotors. In Shanghai, for instance, in 1967, there was a mass upsurge in which the revisionists, these were the capitalist rotors who held entrenched positions of power in that city, there was a mass uprising, the January Shanghai storm, in which there were protests, rallies, reorganization within the factories, and there was an uprising that overthrew this leadership group in Shanghai, the people that ran the city. And on the basis of that, there was incredible discussion and debate about, well, what forms, what institutional form should take the place of this? And this was where the revolutionary leadership played a decisive role in helping to lead the masses to sum up what forms were appropriate to prevent counter-revolution, to enable Shanghai to contribute to the well-being of all of society and the betterment of humanity, and not just to have new forms of self-governance unto themselves. So there was mass debate, mass criticism, mass political mobilization. And the violence that took place during the Cultural Revolution was a very secondary feature, Michael. The audience has been told that this was just crazy violence. No, that was not the principal form. The actual guidance and orientation for the Cultural Revolution emphasized the very themes that I'm talking about. And where there were excesses, these were criticized, and the Maoist revolutionary forces did everything they could to rein this in. And there are many episodes and incidents in which you can see how the revolutionary forces were helping the masses to actually focus on these cardinal questions of what power was for, where society needed to go, and the important role of all of this debate, criticism, and experimentation to further re-revolutionize society and to prevent these capitalist rotors from coming to power. So those were the main forms of struggle. It was a revolution because these new capitalist rotors, these new capitalist forces were the subject, the target of this movement, and they weren't killed. This was not about mass murder. This was not about mass execution. They were overthrown, and the masses were then being led by visionary revolutionary forces to carry this struggle forward, to change how the factories were run, to change forms of governance in the countryside, for instance, where the communes existed. And you see these extraordinary innovations that take place on the basis of the overthrow of these capitalist rotors. So it was a revolution in three profound senses. One, there was the overthrow of these capitalist forces through this process that I'm talking about. Two, it was a revolution because the masses of people were being mobilized and playing the primary role in carrying this forward. And three, it was a revolution because of the innovations, the changes in the institutions in society, in the values, in how people were relating to people. You know, during the Cultural Revolution, the slogan, serve the people. How is my life serving the betterment of society and humanity? That became a yardstick by which people were judging each other in the institutions of society. So it was a profoundly revolutionary, you know, experience. And I think that it's important for people that know very little about this to really ask themselves when they look at an historical episode like this. And this is so critical, Michael, and to your listeners, you know, that we need to actually have an approach that enables us to understand an enormous event like this. And that is, what were the conditions and the circumstances that called forth this struggle? What were its aims and objectives? What were the main ways in which this was being carried out and fought? What were its achievements? How did society change through this? How people related to each other? How people's needs were met? How the condition of women changed? How the gap between the city and the countryside was being overcome? This was all part of the process of the Cultural Revolution. And we have to look at it from the perspective of what this revolution was aiming to do and what it actually accomplished. And what Avakian is allowing us to do is to actually see why it was a breakthrough and also to understand scientifically what its shortcomings and limitations and problems were.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta. And Raymond is one of the foremost experts on the great proletarian cultural revolution in the world, and he's an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism and a writer for Revcom.us and Revolution Newspaper. Now, Raymond, one of the things, as you're talking about these changes, I thought it'd be interesting to just sort of hit on, to a certain degree, one of the big changes that always comes up in reference to this is the idea that the point that so many intellectuals and youth were actually sent from the cities to the countryside. And oftentimes it's presented as something that was really horrible and it was like just total upheaval in these people's lives. And it was like just this sort of forced march into the countryside. What's the truth about that?
Well, first of all, Michael, upheaval is not a bad thing.
Right.
You know, when you're fighting injustice, you know, I remember the stories, you know, in South Africa, you know, in the struggle against apartheid, schools shut down. The high school kids were very much in the van of that struggle. Now, you needed upheaval to go up against apartheid. Now, that struggle didn't succeed in actually wrenching a new radically liberatory society out of that struggle. That's another discussion. But upheaval is not a bad thing. There was upheaval during the Cultural Revolution. The question is, what was this all about? As I said, what prompted it, and where was it leading? And in the case of intellectuals and professionals and doctors going to the countryside, this is a good example of how we can really understand what the Cultural Revolution was about. As I said, there was that initial phase of this mass debate, mass mobilization, the mass criticism, and you had the overthrow of these capitalist, you know, entrenched capitalist elites in various institutions, and you had the schools actually shut down for a period of 2 years because the fact of the matter is the students were being inculcated with bourgeois ideas of getting ahead at the expense of others and knowledge seen as sort of the ticket for a competitive advantage of others, and people were kind of like sealed away in these universities. So in this process, on the basis of these first rounds of struggle, you have an innovation like students going to the countryside, the professionals going to the countryside. And this was not punishment. It was not persecution. It was very, very salient to what it means to create a society that is moving in the direction of communism, of putting an end to all class and social division. Because in the case of China, you had this incredible lopsided development historically, where resources and skills were focused in the cities, culture, and I mentioned health resources before. And during the Cultural Revolution, you have intellectuals, students, and others going to the countryside in order to share their skills and knowledge with peasants and workers, in order to learn from the experience, to learn from the experiences, the daily life experiences of those people that had been kind of seen as an invisible 80% of the Chinese population, the peasants, whom people knew very little about if you were in the cities, other than, well, that's the countryside. People were learning about their life conditions. They were contributing their knowledge and capabilities to overcoming the relative backwardness of the countryside. And also, this was so crucial towards overcoming the division between mental and manual labor, where only a small section of people are enabled to work in the realm of ideas, administration, the arts. In the Cultural Revolution, you have a concerted effort to break down that division between mental and manual labor. So you have people going into the countryside, taking part in the rural activities, in agriculture, being integrated into the life of the peasants, and at the same time, as I said, disseminating knowledge. And you have, as one example, the innovation of open-door research, where scientists from the city went into the countryside and were conducting laboratory experiments alongside the peasants and spreading the scientific method. And at the same time, they were engaged in some of the productive activity that was going on, the agricultural activity that was going on in the countryside. At any given time, one-third of China's medical personnel were rotating into the countryside. So this was aimed at overcoming these gaps and the phenomenon of what you see in today's world, where you have uncontrolled, chaotic urbanization, shanty towns, megacities that are environmentally unsustainable, where there's mass unemployment, you know, huge throngs, millions upon millions flooding into the cities in search of work. Well, in China, this program of sending intellectuals and professionals to the countryside was very much bound up with developing an egalitarian, balanced economy that was not going to take that route of distorted development. And I have to say that here, too, in terms of method and approach and understanding what was going on, we have to see what the aims and objectives were and how things changed. And then you get accounts from people who went to the countryside whose privileges were upended. And for them, this was the worst thing that could have happened. But in fact, it was part of a larger tapestry of social change. And if you just take their partial experience and what they say about, well, I went from the city to the countryside, what could be worse? Well, what could be worse was to perpetuate inequality and class and social division that produces the world that we live in. And people were changing through this. It was very exciting what happened. And you can hear your next guest, Baidi, was one of those people that went to the countryside. But this is what it was about, overcoming that lopsidedness of resources, acquainting broad numbers of people with the life experiences of those, you know, in the countryside, those engaged in manual work. And you're actually creating a society in which people are able to, on the level of peasants and workers, enter into the realm of ideas and working with ideas, and where intellectuals who were trained as a special caste were seeing their knowledge in relation to the betterment of society and humanity, and themselves beginning to see society more broadly in terms of how other sections of society are contributing to the actual well-being of society.
Mm-hmm. Now, Raymond, we have about 6 minutes left, and I want to actually ask you, I have two questions, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to do this. One is that the way that you're talking about what happened in the Cultural Revolution is not the prevailing view of the Cultural Revolution in the world today. And you've mentioned before that a lot of this has to do with the way the history is written in terms of the scar literature, history by memoir. Maybe you could touch on that. But I also wanted to make the point that the defeat of the Cultural Revolution closed out the first stage of communist revolution. That's a point that you make in a piece that you've written. And I wanted to talk about where to now. And you've brought up Bob Avakian. And I thought it'd be really important to sort of point out what is the role that Bob Avakian has played in relation to going further.
Yeah, Avakian has written widely on the Cultural Revolution. And what he has done, he kind of rose to fill a great historic need, because the Cultural Revolution was defeated in 1976. The very forces that Mao was warning against were able to seize power after Mao's death. And Avakian applied himself to analyzing what had happened in China, why the Cultural Revolution was defeated. For 10 years, hundreds of millions of people were engaged in this extraordinary process that I've been describing of revolutionizing society, revolutionizing their outlook, their values, their ways of thinking, of relating to each other, and gaining the ability to understand the world and to change it. Avakian has summed up that overwhelmingly the Cultural Revolution was defeated by the stronger forces of counter-revolution, both in Chinese society and on a world scale. And he also brought forth an understanding of what the real and incredible breakthroughs were of the Cultural Revolution, and what Mao had discovered about the nature of socialist society that we touched on. At the same time, Avakian, in fighting for a scientific understanding of the Cultural Revolution, its breakthroughs, also identified shortcomings and weaknesses. Now, these shortcomings and weaknesses were not the principal cause of the defeat of the Cultural Revolution, but they contributed to that defeat. And Avakian has identified some of these things. Your interview with him last week was communicating some of that, but he does speak to some of the problems. For instance, there were tendencies to reify. He uses this word reify. There were tendencies to see workers and peasants as being intrinsically receptive to correct understanding, and a view that intellectuals were somewhat of a problem people, if you will. And there was a problem there insofar as the importance of intellectual and cultural ferment and dissent in socialist society was not fully appreciated by Mao. And this idea that intellectuals have to have their thinking remolded because they are specifically given to notions of self and self-advancement is not correct. Everyone's thinking has to be revolutionized, peasants and workers, and everyone has to be able to take up the scientific method of understanding and changing the world, going deep into what are the actual root forces in society, the dynamics of socialist society. It needs to unleash, the socialist revolution needs to unleash incredible ferment and dissent. But there was a certain restrictiveness on this, even as the Cultural Revolution was unprecedented. Never has there been such incredible debate and mass participation. But there were, even in the Cultural Revolution, these problems. There was an official ideology. Communism was the official ideology. And those people who would be raising big questions about socialism and communism would not necessarily be getting a hearing. And this actually prevents you from getting a deep understanding of society, because people who disagree, who may even oppose the revolution, could have incredible insights into the shortcomings and problems of the revolution. And you need to unleash this incredible process of getting at the truth of society, whoever says it, however uncomfortable those truths are, in order to more deeply understand society and the world and to change it. Vakian has spoken about these things, and there's much more we could get into in terms of some of the weaknesses of the Cultural Revolution, but he has brought forth a framework to carry forward from the Cultural Revolution and at the same time to go beyond it, a new framework for making an even more emancipatory revolution in today's world. And the crucial breakthrough that Avakian has made is putting communism on a thoroughly scientific foundation, enabling humanity to deeply, truly, and continually, through a deepening process, understand the world in order to change it in the interests of world humanity, to get to that society and world without classes and class exploitation, in which we do have a world community of humanity.
All right, Raymond, we're going to have to real quick. I want to ask you this. Tell people where, if they want to find out more about this, where can they go?
Where they can go is to revcom.us. And that's where there's lots of recent articles on the Cultural Revolution and the 50th anniversary commemoration and Avakian's work. And they can also go to thisiscommunism.org. This is the website of Set the Record Straight. I'm the director of that project. And this is where you can get lots and lots of information. Thisiscommunism.org on the truth of the Bolshevik and the Chinese revolutions. Go deep into issues of the economy, art, the emancipation of women, where you can hear voices of the Cultural Revolution and specialized analysis of the Great Leap Forward and other aspects of these revolutions. So that's thisiscommunism.org. And it's very important because the stakes of this question, the battle for the truth of the Cultural Revolution, is not just an idle historical question. It has everything to do with people coming to understand what really happened in the Cultural Revolution and the Chinese Revolution and the truth of that and the possibility, the need, and the urgency of making revolution in today's world.
All right, Raymond. Raymond, All right, Raymond, thank you very much for joining us today. And I look forward to talking to you again, man. We should really dig into this more as we go along, all right?
Okay, great.
All right, take care, man.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Raymond Lotta, one of the foremost experts in the world on the Cultural Revolution in China. And he's also the author, he's the author of You Don't Know What You Think You Know About the Communist Revolution and the Real Path to Emancipation, Its History and Our Future. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Getting in a mischief, I'm listening. I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a heated wave through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those eyes. There is a rose now, dance tonight, can't tell me with my eyes will see.
Welcome back, that was Outer National with Here Is the Rose. All right, we're going to just jump into this next segment. It's a very special segment. I did this interview about 10 years ago with Bai Di. I am really pleased to welcome my guest for today. Her name is Bai Di. She's the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University. She's also the co-editor of a book called Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up in the Mao Era. Di, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael, for having me.
Sure. People who listen to this show regularly know that I am a revolutionary. I'm a communist. They also know that I uphold a period of history that, by and large, is vilified, at least in terms of what you see. You cannot mention the Cultural Revolution in China, the Chinese Revolution, and especially the Cultural Revolution in China, without having someone come up with a whole, just a bucket full of horror stories about what went on there. The whole thing has been dismissed and vilified, and it's ruled out of order to even talk about it. Well, in the face of that, Bai Di has stepped out, and she's been speaking and doing a lot of work actually countering the master narrative. Dee, I guess actually my first question for you is, I read a comment from you once that said that you were really grateful to have grown up in an extremely special moment in Chinese history. And you spent your life since then, quite a bit of your life and your effort, in opposition to that master narrative I was talking about revolutionary China and the Cultural Revolution. And it seems to be a really unique effort in the world today. And tell me, is it so unique, really? And why have you come to this point?
First of all, I have to say it's not my own individual effort to do that, because our book, Some of Us, A Chinese Woman Growing Up in Mao Era, is a collective effort by three of us editors, co-editors Zhong Xueping, Wang Zheng, and I. And also we have a group of Chinese professional women right now working in the United States contributed into this volume. And in recent years, more and more people already came out and talk about their own experiences in China, especially in the Mao era, we call it, roughly from 1949 to 1976, when Mao died. So to answer your question, and all of us felt that in the United States and in China right now, there's this master narrative that you have to say that Cultural Revolution in the Mao time, Mao era, was a disaster. Was a kind of atrocity, basically, oppressing people, victimized a lot of people. And the literature will come out, all focused on how they're victimized, how they're persecuted in the revolution. And then that painted kind of a picture that is a gloomy, very dark kind of 10 years of the Cultural Revolution. So when I first came to the United States in 1989, and I came across with this, several memoirs widely read at the moment. One is Red Azalea, another one is Wild Swan. And then, so I think in the mid-90s, and some of us Chinese women studying in the United States, we had the time, we just got together and we realized we have to get our own voice heard, because we felt kind of angry that 10 years period could be painted as such, it's manufactured as such a kind of a period. And then here in the U.S., the popular readers, I mean, in the populace of the U.S. will accept that as the true picture of the Cultural Revolution. So then we took up that effort to write this book. For me, the Cultural Revolution formed my childhood, the whole childhood. I was born in mid-50s, so when Cultural Revolution started, I was 11 years old. And right now, when I look back, not only right now, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when I look back, I have to say that's the best time of my life.
Well, that's very interesting. That's what I wanted to get into a little bit. Why is that? What was it like?
So number one, because I look at things from gender perspective, my major here, I'm teaching women's studies. I think as a girl, growing up in that era, it's a zero, very liberating for women and girls. And then I think that we were expected, the society expected girls as good, doing stuff as good as boys. And then I, from the very beginning, felt that I was not only equal to all the boys, but I was better. I mean, in a way, because I think the social, and right now they call it propaganda, but the social ideology was such that Mao Zedong said that women could hold half of the sky for all his women's liberation platform. I think that is the dominant ideology of the time. And then later on, I studied the model theater, the model plays, eight plays, and you can see that all the women's images in those plays representing the strong women, and women can do what men can do. So that's a predominant ideology at the time.
I want to talk more about women, and in particular women in the arts, as we get deeper into the interview. But one of the things I read that you made a comparison between, you said, look, if people aren't aware of what happened in pre-revolutionary China, the position of women was just horrendous, from just the objectification of women, the most grotesque things like the bound feet, and the position of women in relation to the patriarchal thinking and ideological positions around that. And you made a comparison where you said it was very interesting to you that the first thing they did in China after the revolution, the first law that they passed was the marriage law. And some of the points that you made about why that was so significant, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I said I always compare the three generations of women in my family, because usually people will say, why you have to think about that? I think sometimes your own experiences that can show a great deal of that. my both grandmothers on both sides, my mother and my father, they're both literate. They were both born at the turn of the 20th century, and they both married very early. In that interview, I said that one at age of 14, another at age of 15. Yes, they both had bound feet, and each of them gave birth to 14 kids. And then the marriage was arranged, both, and then they both are illiterate. That I don't think they did anything more in their life than raising kids and giving birth to kids. And three of my mother's brothers died in infancy, so when they were infants. So that's what my grandmother's life, both. And my mother's life, the second generation, is totally different. He was born at the turn of the 30s. So basically, when the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, she was a teenager and she was ready to go to college. The next year, she went to college to study Russian, screening to be a diplomat, to study in Moscow at that point. And then I think that both my parent generation, both my father and my mother, were the first generation got college education. So my mother was a translator and researcher in Russian literature before she retired. And when I grew up, I was more ambitious than my mother, I think, because I feel that I would, my mother knew three languages. She speaks Chinese and Russian and English. So I aimed high. I have to take more because I studied Russian and German before I took up English and then French. So it's very interesting. I always look at that to see why three generations. Basically, we covered 20th century because mm-hmm. my grandparents were born at the beginning of the 20th century. And then I think my mother and I enjoyed greatly, really, from the Communist Revolution.
Well, tell me this. You were talking about the individual stories and the social context that they were in. But in particular, in relation to the social context, the importance of something like the marriage law, I mean, to me, it was phenomenal. In fact, it really struck me when you said that it wasn't the Constitution, it wasn't any other law, it was the marriage law that got changed. And that was
yes.
a very important thing. Can you tell people what the marriage law was and why it was so important?
Okay. So when after the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, the second year, the central government passed two laws for the new China. Number one, in May, that was a marriage law. So the marriage law, for the first time in Chinese history, deemed that arranged marriage, selling for women, concubinage system, all illegal. And it advocated, it says that the men and women should be equal. The family is a place that men and women should help each other. And it's also the freedom of choosing your spouse for the first time in Chinese history. After the marriage law is issued, then all this, you know, at that point, some guys still have concubines, so they have to choose one wife, basically. So that exercised great impact on the women's lives. And of course, a month later, the second law was issued, that is the land reform law. So you can see Mao Zedong's caring for the peasantry, because at that time, peasants consist of 90% of Chinese population. And then that's land reform law. So I always look at that. It's because the first marriage law represented the Chinese Communist Party the changing of ideology, changing the social superstructure of society, try to use law to regulate what is kind of a gender relation would be, and also familial relation would be. And of course, the land reform law was the first one to deal with the base, economic base, that you have to give peasants the land in order to build a nicer society. Give every peasant a piece of land, that is.
Now, we'll come back to the peasantry in a minute, but I want to pursue one more thing in relation to women, because you had that happen in the beginning of the People's Republic of China, in the beginning of revolutionary China. Mm-hmm. But then there was a further leap that happened when the Cultural Revolution developed. What was the content of that? What difference did it make to women that the Cultural Revolution unfolded the way it did?
I think the Cultural Revolution started right now. People say, what is the intention of Mao's Cultural Revolution? My reading, I sincerely believe that Mao feels that the continuous revolution, because after the communists took over the country and made all China, everything's state-owned, that is collectively owned. However, people have to change their thinking. They have to get rid of the old ideas and old thought. And also, if people didn't do that continuously, and then the capitalists will return, a feudalism would return. So that may be the purpose of Mao's Cultural Revolution. And I think for women, the Cultural Revolution further strengthened the idea that women and men are equal. I think that before the Cultural Revolution, 17 years after the founding of the People's Republic, there was 17 years there, women made a great stride in terms of emancipation, in terms of their achievement in different areas of life, different walks of life. But in the Cultural Revolution, I think that was the peak. in Chinese history. Right now, I'm writing a book on that, the women's liberation in the Cultural Revolution in several fronts. Number one, the images, the mass media. They build up women's images as heroic figures rather than wives and the concubines and fragile beauties. They were revolutionaries. They were constructors for the socialist revolution, socialist construction. That's number one. Number two, in the political spectrum, and Cultural Revolution asked for three combinations, that kind of leadership for each unit or each province or each city. If you want to have a new government, revolutionary government, you have to have a women's representation. So that was the first time the women really in the leadership in every level of government.
One of the things I wanted to ask you in relation to all this is that the common picture of the Cultural Revolution is that it was like hordes of fanatical teenage zealots who were running through the countryside and sort of ideologically enslaving people, enslaved themselves, ideologically enslaved. They were running through the cities, the countries, and they were just turning China into a very robotic society with just straight thinking, repeating the religious catechism of Mao thought. And that's the image that's put there. And so what was your experience? How would you counter that? What was it like in relation to that?
I think that if you think the whole process for Cultural Revolution, it was 10 years, right? That right now they think about Cultural Revolution is 10 years. I always feel that when you think about young people went to countryside, all these, that's in the first few years. That the Red Guards movement only lasted, I think, for about 2 or 3 years. So to answer your question, I think that there are two moments, that historical moments in that 10 years, that young people would go down to the countryside, to the factories. That's, one is in 1966. That's the Red Guards movement. Okay. The second one is the Sandang youth. That is the educated youth were sent down to the countryside in order to be re-educated by the peasants. So I'm not sure which one you're mentioning.
First, let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And I'm speaking today with Bai Di, the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University, the co-editor of Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up During the Mao Era. One of the things I'm trying to understand is that, and I think maybe I posed the question a little oddly when I asked it, but when you're talking about this youth going to the countryside, I think I told you the other day when we were first speaking that I just saw this movie called Turning Point 1977. And the whole idea there was that the youth who went to the countryside were so terribly oppressed that going to the countryside was like a prison sentence. They spent 11 years there, and when Deng Xiaoping came in and signed the law that said they were reinstituting the college entrance exam and everybody would be able to take it and get into college based on their scores, that there was just this widespread elation among the students, and they couldn't get out of the countryside fast enough. Were you sent to the countryside?
Yes.
Can you tell us what?
I was not sent to. Mm-hmm. I volunteered.
Okay, well, that's even better. That's even better. Let's talk about that because, you know, that's the thing that people get is like that couldn't have happened. She volunteered? Come on. Why did you volunteer and what did you find when you got there?
See, you have to think about the mode of the era. I always felt that I was a revolutionary. I was about to make a change in the society. So when I was graduating from middle school or high school, you call it, I was 16 years old. And that's in 1971 already. And then the state had a policy at that point that you could stay in the city to be a worker or to do whatever the situation allowed. And then I was the firstborn, so I supposed to be staying in Harbin, in the city. But I didn't like it. I always think that I should go to the countryside because people at that time, the educated youth, was sent down to the countryside in order to receive the re-education from the peasants. So Mao's idea was that the youth, especially from urban areas, they had very limited understanding of society. In other words, they were privileged. When you're privileged and you didn't understand 80% of the Chinese population, that is peasants, so you should go there to understand what is the reality of China and what can you do to help those people. And then, so that was the Mao's calling for the educated youth to go to the countryside. That started in 1964, before the Cultural Revolution. But then the massive educated youth would go to the countryside starting in 1968. And I didn't really catch up with that because I was a bit younger. But when my time came, And I just say, hey, I want to go to the countryside because I feel that, number one, maybe my ideology was not that pure because sometimes I've got kind of bourgeois this and that because I came from, I was born into an intellectual family. So I feel that I needed to be re-educated by the president. At the same time, and then we firmly believe at that point that the steel is tempered. You cannot get strong without trying times. And then what can be trying times at that point is a physical labor. Basically, if you go to the countryside, you really have to work hard in the field, use hoes or use sickles. So that kind of physical labor. So I think that I should go there to do that. But then I went to the countryside. I went to this farm. And that was the year that I didn't write in my book, but then that was the most memorable time of my life because we were very idealistic. We were very tired every day. We worked like 10 hours in the field, but we were singing songs, and we feel that we used our own hands. We're making something. We were making something. We're not a parasite anymore. I don't know why we thought we were a parasite because from you were born until a certain age, you're a consumer, right? You're a consumer of other people's labor. At that point, it was just that feel of love to work. I think that drove me to the countryside. And then basically, I was forced back. The whole group, like 700 people. And the next year, in 1972, and then the municipal government came over and said, no, we want you to be a teacher. We want to train you to be foreign language teachers or something. And we all boycotted. We said, no, we want to stay here.
Boy, that's a very different picture than what's normally presented. Interesting. When you were talking about this, you brought up the thing about the intelligentsia and your self-perception of maybe you were parasites, and then you thought, I don't know why we thought that. One of the things I was kind of curious about, because this is also something that's oftentimes used to vilify the Cultural Revolution, is that the Cultural Revolution meant that people's thinking was confined to a red box. That critical thinking, exploration in arts and science and other forms of human endeavor and knowledge, that those kinds of things were ruled out of order and that everybody more or less had to become basically Maoist robots. And that was in order to thrive. And if you didn't, then you would be in big trouble. What was your experience in that?
I feel that that's a misrepresentation because to think about science technology, I think China's atom bomb and then the hydrogen bomb and also the satellite, all these high-tech stuff which really happened during the Cultural Revolution. We have to say that, okay? So I think that the engineers and the technical, in that regard, they were still developing. In terms of ideological, that side, I feel that it's just opposite. I feel that the Cultural Revolution, the very first, Chairman Mao asked the young people, or for that matter, the people, all China, to have a critical mind, that you don't to be a kind of slavery into some ideology. I think Mao said, the rebellion is the right way to doing things. So I started to challenge what my mother said, what my father said, whether they are okay or not, at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. And I feel that my generation is very critical. Even now, when I came to the United States and people said, oh, you didn't like that you went through Cultural Revolution because it seemed that you are very critical of everything. And I said, that's exactly trained in the Cultural Revolution. You analyze and you use your own thinking. I think that's what Mao thought. Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Yes, absolutely. Now, explain something to me, though. You know, the other thing related to this is in terms of this, there's the critical thinking aspect. And then there's also the idea that somehow society was totally regimented and that there wasn't the kind of debate and dissent and discussion that would, humans would want to live in that kind of society full of that kind of discussion and debate. What was your experience in the Cultural Revolution? Was it a very gray society and one-dimensional and just sort of you did what you were told, even if you were critically thinking, if there were some people? How did this play itself out among the masses of people broadly?
I think there's two sides. I mean, some people may never like kind of a thinking or something. I don't know that, because I think that always, see, the Cultural Revolution, you have to have revolution in your everyday life. You have to do self-criticism all the time. I don't think a lot of people like that. That's really true, especially intellectuals, if they live a very privileged life, and then the revolution came, and since it's called the revolution, like Chairman Mao said, it's not to invite people to dinner. Let's just have a talk. it's sometimes could be violence. The revolution will result in change, violent change, tremendous changes. And some people may not like changes that much because they're in a privileged position. But then for the most people, I feel that for me, I think that it's a free, the most free thinking period of my life. Seriously, I use the superlative degree because we are criticized a lot of things. We started to learn the world affairs to understand what is the U.S. and Martin Luther King that came up. So I don't know. I feel that it's a lot. But maybe for some people, if their privileges were challenged, then maybe they just feel bad. Mm-hmm. And then that's really true. I think there was a kind of a sense that is you have to do the right thing. You have to do the self-criticism. And you have to always think about your position in the society. Mm-hmm. And then now, what can you contribute? And you always feel kind of bad if you couldn't contribute to something. I think that's really later on. I think sometimes cultural revolution really, later on really push to some kind of a extreme in a way that it's really, really bothers some people. I think that's why after the cultural revolution, so-called the scar literature came back, and a lot of people say, hey, I never liked to be a revolutionary. And I was like hijacked to be one.
So the scar literature is this seemingly endless series of books that talk about how terribly oppressed people were during the Cultural Revolution, their personal experiences of oppression. That's what you're referring to as scar.
Exactly. Yeah. In the 80s, and especially in the 80s, because in the 90s in China, the trend changed because they came back and with the early 90s, there's a Mao phase and Mao fad or something. So the people started to respect more of Mao Zedong. But then in the 80s, in that 10 years, and I feel that was where all these people came out writing about the terrible times in the Cultural Revolution. But for me, I feel the two things about that period, because I'm teaching the literature of that period right now. Number one is that those who wrote literature were the targets, actually, of the revolution.
All right, that was Bai D, that's B-A-I-D-I. All right, and Bai Di is an assistant professor at Drew University, and she is the head of the Chinese and Asian Studies Department there. She's also the co-author of the book, Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up in the Mao Era. I also want to let people know that the full interview with Bai Di, which is a really interesting interview, is going to be on my website, themichaelslateshow.com. Again, that's themichaelslateshow.com. All right, real quick, I want to thank all of my guests today, Raymond Latta and Bai Di. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor, Alex Brenner, and Matt Kwiklinski. And I want to thank my engineer for today, Kiana Williams-Turner. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.